Phil, there are so many great television shows and movies.
That's right. Thank goodness Resonance Rewind has the team to analyze them on a personal basis.
Flesh against human flesh. We're the same. We share the same history, the same heritage, the same lives. We're tied together beyond any untying. Man or woman, it makes no difference. We're human. We couldn't escape each other even if we wanted to. That's how you do it, Lieutenant, by remembering who and what you are, a bit of flesh and blood afloat in a universe without end. The only thing that's truly yours is the rest of humanity. That's where our duty lies. Strong words, ideally suited for another episode of Resonance Rewind.
Thank you.
Would you have gathered some laurel leaves? That's the question. We'll find out as we go through the resume and the précis of the episode, of course, with Robin Pierce. How are you, Robin?
Hello, good evening. Right, we are talking about Season 2, Episode 2 of Star Trek, first broadcast September 22nd, 1967. Who Mourns for Adonis? Written by Gilbert Ralston and Gene L. Coon, directed by Mark Daniels. Now, the Enterprise is flying through space like it does when all of a sudden it is stopped by a giant glowing green hand, which is hands down, see what I did there? One of the best starts to a Star Trek ever done. Captain James T. Kirk, of course, tries to get out of the grip, but can't. A humanoid apparition appears on the bridge view screen, addresses the ship's crew. Kirk demands that the ship be set free, but the being responds by tightening its grip, threatening to crush the Enterprise like an egg, until Kirk agrees to the being's demands that the ship's crew be beamed down to the planet below. Well, it's, of course, it's only a landing party. The team arrives at what appears to be an ancient Greek temple where they encounter the humanoid who claims to be the god Apollo. He informs the party that he will not allow them to leave. He renders them, the team's communicators and transporter room, non-functional and says that he expects the Enterprise crew to worship him as their ancestors had done. And in return, he promises to provide for all of their needs and desires. Kirk, of course, refuses, and let's take it from there.
I have to point out for the listener, Jonathan Lindsley seems to be beaming in and beaming out. Maybe he'll cut together. Maybe he won't. We know that we're going to be without, obviously, Jessica Burtis because she's got Wi-Fi issues, etc. And I think hopefully we will actually have a person who's responsible for bringing together a unique interpretation of the Star Trek theme coming to us from New York, where at least there's some kind of solidity and safety on this. Honestly, it's like trying to actually coordinate folk together on a pilgrim's progress. But the
you might as well try to herd tribbles.
Yeah, but you know, at least they give you something. Love, of course, which is at the heart of this episode, the love for humanity, the love for all sorts of things. And indeed, it also ties in with, of course, two of our extra special guests, as usual, and regulars, Pamela Suman. Welcome, Pamela. Are you keeping well? She's currently actually engaging in mastication. I'll say that again, mastication. She's chewing material, so it's okay. We can identify this, and I'll talk and feel whilst we also go through somebody who has a direct connection with this particular episode of Who Mourns for Adonis, because he's worked with Michael Forrest. Some people would actually say he is Bones McCoy, even more so than indeed DeForest Kelly possibly have been Bones McCoy, but it's Larry Nemechek. Welcome, Larry. How are you? Welcome, of course, to the joys of course, we call it Pilgrim of Eternities prequel.
Well, that's what we call it. Yes. No, that's a very large claim there about D. Kelly. No, nobody will ever. No one will ever replace D. Kelly, and even Carl Urban, who came very, very, very close. So thank you for having us again, Alex. This is great.
Larry, we've had the précis. Robin's provided the sort of overview of the whole thing. We look back now, obviously, over 50 years, written by Gilbert Ralston, directed by, I think, Mark Daniels.
Yes.
Some moments which are a little bit awkward, perhaps, in terms of, obviously, Scotty's romantic life, which he doesn't do very well, actually. I mean, if we go from this one to the season three episode Lights of Zetar, right. I mean, there's a lot of sadness in that Scotsman. But, you know, allowing for that, what were your thoughts on Who Mourns for Adonis?
Well, I did rewatch this in prep for our discussion today, and there were a couple of cringy moments, although they kind of redeemed themselves. There's a minute where Kirk and McCoy are talking about how, oh, she's a woman and we'll have her for a while, then she'll go get married and have the family and love it. But then she starts off that way, but then she does get to redeem herself a little bit as far as a character goes. And the culture of the times is redeemed a little bit, where she takes her orders. She snaps back into being an officer. She stands up to him. She's, you know, she's a loyal soldier. She's not just swept off in the princessy, you know, knight in shining armor way. So about the time you think it may skid off the rails into some pre-feminism, it kind of comes back a little bit. But I was just noticing a lot of little details around the edges. But at the same time, it's also good to see Uhura under the hood. They're working on her station at times. Although I'm wondering why, as a communications ops red person, she's wearing a blue science coveralls. But that's beside the point, which I never thought of before until last night. It's that good old Star Trek, we have to struggle for ourselves versus just be handed everything trope. And it does, it's fine, has a great soundtrack. It was never one of my top favorites, but I kind of appreciated it a little more rewatching now. I hadn't sat down and actually forced myself to watch it a long time. And there are bits and pieces that I did appreciate more, I believe. And we can get into this, but the whole saga of how the ending was altered for network television.
I mean, let's face it, James Blish left it uncut, and she was going to have a child. It could have been a whole new Brace of Gods. It could have been a whole new set of Eternals, but that's another franchise.
Another franchise.
Exactly. Pamela, now you've composed yourself. I know you've had PTA meetings. You've got New York to deal with. You've got musical careers. You've got all sorts of other areas. Plus, of course, you brought us a wonderful rendition of the vocalized version of the Star Trek theme. But before we move into that, would you like to explain your thoughts or share your thoughts about this particular season two episode?
Well, first of all, I have to say that I'm honored to be brought into the fold because I think the last time we spoke, Larry, we all spoke, it was the summer, I think, and we were just talking about, I was asking you questions about Star Trek, and now I feel like I have been brought in, and I'm watching it, and one thing, and actually Jerry watched it with me last night, one thing that is so cool is that when you're in the Star Trek, you know, state of mind, and you're there, it's like you've joined this cult, and you're in the cult, and you're part of it, and you drank the Kool-Aid, and you're there for the ride. And I realize what's so special about it, I'm speaking generally, but not about this episode as much for the moment, is that they're a team, they're cohesive, you know, this hand comes and, you know, and like, sticks them and they're there together and they have this camaraderie and they wear the coolest clothes and they have the coolest banter and they all look so groovy and they're all such characters. Their hair is so bizarre. It's so wonderful on so many levels. I mean, I'm just tipping the superficial. I haven't even gotten to the depth yet. And then, I mean, William Shatner and Leonard Nimoy. It's like crazy. So I can see how people just like probably like leave their lives and join the cult of Star Trek. It's great.
I did sense the hand of Gene Roddenberry in this episode, quite literally. It is his hand that's actually there that holds the Enterprise in place. Finally, after some teleportation difficulties and some transportation issues, Jonathan Lindsley has managed to connect with us. And if he can unmute, he may also be able to share his thoughts with respect to Hormones for Adonis. Jonathan, it's over to you. Press that button now, and you were connected.
Like and subscribe.
You're okay now.
I'm unmuted. Can you hear me? Okay, so I enjoyed this immensely, and it was great because I had a vague memory of it the first time around, I think, when it was first broadcast, and because I was a bit of a Star Trek fan, so I've got to make that as a confession first up. Second thing about this, there were some wonderful lines in it. I made a note of my favourite line, which was when Kirk called Scotty a stiff-necked thistlehead, which I thought was a brilliant line. And I also love the line that Kirk said when talking about humankind. He said, "We have no need of gods. One is quite enough," which I thought was a rather splendid reference as well. So there were a couple of lines in it that really struck me. Good performances and generally, I think it's good storytelling, basically. I enjoyed every minute of it, really. No criticism.
Wow. So suddenly Jonathan's back in the light side of the force again after several weeks going down a sort of grumpy sort of aspect. Robin, you've heard the sort of views of that point. You've got the professional actor's viewpoint. I mean, Larry, as I say, you did obviously work with Michael Forrest in I mean, just explain for the benefit of the listener, etc., Star Trek Continues, which was shot a few years ago now. But what was the sort of general idea of that, and also the connectivity behind continuing the story and having that sequel?
Well, Star Trek Continues was maybe the apex of fan films, although there were a lot of professional people involved in it. And the charm and the beauty of fan films were that Star Trek fan films, anyway, was that they were, you know, they were mom and pop generated, and some of them, they were all over the place in terms of quality. Some of them had a great reach, but basically they initially, like basically around 2000, focus on the original series, because the generation that was coming of age to accomplish this, you know, make a movie on your laptop, YouTube was coming in, but that was a generation that came up on the original series for the most part. And this original series uniforms and sets were easier to mock and recreate, you know, plywood and Christmas lights. But Star Trek Continues, I feel like, was kind of the apex of that, because the whole gist was, we're not just going to wear the costumes and build the sets, even slavishly, anally get blueprints and all that. It was also, there was a big attention paid to writing and having professional writers work, and usually professionals who are also a fan, because it was done for little if no money. There was crowdfunding later on, but also there was a conceit made not to be seduced by, say, modern CGI or modern filmmaking or even 16:9 framing. You know, it was 4:3, old 60. The whole point was to recreate the fourth and or fifth season as if they'd happened. So we're going to make Star Trek from 1969 or 1970. And that led down, even the way it was edited, shot, you know, lit, everything was trying to be a recreation of that time, not just the acting style, the direction, the pacing, everything. And not just, oh, look, here's Star Trek. We remember it. And now we're going to do all the things we never had a chance to do. And the proof of concept after three little vignettes was, right, Pilgrim of Eternity. Mike Forrest, who still has his chops, was Apollo in this. And they got him back, and his wife had a cameo too. She'd been an actress, to basically do a follow-up sequel to this. You know, we're doing it 30 years later, 50 years later almost, but in Star Trek canon time, it was meant to be like the fourth season. So this was 2-3 years later in real time. And they basically, to account for Michael Forrest obviously being a little an actor, there's a process that he has accelerated in aging, And then something happens in the plot that gives him back some of his youth. And he's an old, decrepit, sad figure that you would expect coming out of this plot. But that a couple of things happen along the way where he gets his old vigor and his old, you know, dominating spirit
because
back.
Because people start worshiping him.
So people worship him again. It's a wonderful thing. And they detect that his organ has regrown. The organ that McCoy talks about has regrown. So he's able to generate, you know, telekinesis and be a power director. And it was a really, and then it winds up just as forlornly as the first one does, only this time in a more positive way. So it was the proof of concept of Star Trek Continues, and people were blown away by Mike Forrest acting again. And he did some acting work after this as well. He's done, you know, voiceovers and things you'd expect an older veteran actor to do in their later years, but he has done some actual acting too. But it was amazing. He told the story of he and Leonard Nimoy were in a play together on the East Coast in New York, and he remembered Leonard saying, "Oh my God, I'm going to go out and do this stupid pilot and put these ears on for this guy doing this sci-fi. I don't know if I should do it or not." And he was like, "Oh, come on, it's work. Go do it." So he, you know, things like that. And the other thing I really remember him talking about was the blue screen effects where Apollo grows. The director wasn't, you know, it wasn't as cut and dried an era in those days, and they didn't have an effects guy on the visual effects team, wasn't there to supervise direct. They were all kind of figuring it out, and somebody from the vendor's house came, from the special effects vendor, came in to kind of supervise it. And the actual director there, Mark Daniels, hadn't done anything like this. And they were just talking about it, and they were talking about how they would do it. And Mike said, he said, just like, "Oh, hell, let's just go for it and try one." And they did it with the acting and the tech going at the same time. And they did it on the first take, and that's the one that you see used.
Sounds like an episode of Last of the Summer Wine to me. That's all you actually needed, really, Jonathan. Just a little bit more sort of CGI in there, bit of compo, bit of Clegg, bang, it's done. That's for another sort of thing. The other thing, of course, very briefly before we turn to Robin, which I was particularly taken by, was I think it's James Doohan's son, Chris Doohan, who actually took on board the role of Scotty. Is that right?
Mm-hmm. Oh, yes, yeah. Yes.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
The
amazing
accent, he doesn't quite nab the accent as his father does. That's all I have to say. But it's a charming routine, and I'd heartily recommend people actually check it out.
Many would say that James Doohan sometimes does not nail the accent quite as
Join me, Carolyn. Robin, over to yourself. What are your thoughts on this one?
Well, I remember this is one of a small, very small handful of Star Trek episodes that I remember from the first run. I remembered, I mean, later on, of course, when they were repeated ad infinitum on the BBC here in the UK, I've always remembered the big green hand. And I was a little bit, when I bought the new reissue Blu-rays, I made sure that I got the set with both the original effects and the new CGI effects, so I could switch in between them if I took against the interference of the new CGI effects. But I have to say that hand has never, ever looked better. Now, as far as this episode goes, it's one of my favorites because, like others on this panel, I mean, I usually love the episodes set on the Enterprise itself. I'm less keen on a lot of the location and other series standing set episodes. Just don't ask me about Patterns of Force, like, ever. This is the studio bound exterior, and I absolutely love those because they feel so claustrophobic. I mean, they are, I suppose, half-heartedly meant to give the illusion of a vast planet, but we all know it's a soundstage, and that works well. Now, the first time I ever saw this, it was actually in black and white, and that heightened the weirdness of there just being this one kind of Grecian structure. There was a whole planet, but we didn't care about, there's just this one Grecian structure. It struck me as so memorable. The only other that I remember that well from the first run was the Wild West episode in the third season.
Spectre of the Gun.
Where you only had Spectre of the Gun, where you only had the front facades of the buildings, and when he walked in, you know, all the furniture was there, clocks hanging in midair. This is the kind of story that Star Trek presented visually so well with a limited budget. But also, I thought the writing on this one, you know, it's basically taking the old adage of, if a tree falls in a forest and there's nobody around to hear it, did it really happen? Does it make a sound? And of course, if there is a God and there's nobody there to worship him, is he still a God? And I think that Michael Forrest brings so much to this role because he is vain, he is capricious, and he's also extremely vulnerable, like a child needing, you know, the support and the validation. And it does it so, so well. I mean, the sheer audacity. I mean, they always talked about Star Trek at some point meeting God. But of course, that can never happen because everybody thinks of God in a different way. And if you portray him one way, then you've just offended everybody
or her,
else.
Or her.
Thank you. Get out my pen.
And you know, that could never happen. But the audacity to meet a Greek God takes all of that sort of, you know, sort of offense away. And for him not to be an alien pretending to be a Greek god, but to actually be the Greek god, I thought was absolutely superb. And this episode is just head and shoulders above what I think is its nearest neighbor of Plato's Stepchildren.
Hmm. we can come back to that at another time. But Pamela, just explain the rationale for your selection, not of one of your own compositions, but of somebody who you know quite closely, who's actually did a version of the Star Trek theme, as, of course, sung by Nichelle Nichols back in the 60s. But this time it's an original that you did, I think, sometime in the 90s.
Absolutely. Well, you know, one can only be so greedy. and also, you know, we talked about doing a cover, which was, but we just didn't have the time. So Jamie Edwards, a brilliant keyboardist, synth producer guy, went to New England Conservatory, which is a fantastic classical school. And he is just, he's brilliant and funny. He's got a really good sense of humor. So apparently in the 90s, he was working with this singer called Lisa Shepherd Hadley, and they were doing something in a concert hall, a performance in the concert hall. And he suggested they do Star Trek. And she walked by his theremin. He had a theremin in the studio. And so he started playing the Star Trek, you know, theme on the theremin, which is quite an instrument if anyone has ever seen it. It works on like electromagnetic force field or something. Anyway, so they decided to brilliantly do a version of it, which they performed live, and it brought the house down. And you can even hear the house being brought down at the end of the recording. But I must say, it's Lisa Mattoon on the flute, I believe. Jean Mattoon on the flute, Lisa Shepherd Hadley on vocals, and Jamie Edwards on piano and in arrangement, and it is just excellent.
Awesome track there. And of course, being that this is the magic of the business of show, we clearly actually sort of have only got Pamela and myself who've currently actually heard that as yet. The rest of the panel will actually hear it if they play the show back again. That's very important. You know, it's the way it's sort of edited in. It's done in post. That's the whole thing, done in post. Okay. Jonathan, I'll turn to your good self again. In terms of characters, you know, we always talk about characters and so on. I'd actually disagree with Robin. I think Patterns of Force has a great character in terms of the Adolf Hitler scientist or the scientist who is his historian. I think it's quite poignant, but that's another line. In terms of this one, Did you feel that anybody stood out? Was it Leslie Parrish's Carolyn Palamas? Was it Michael Forrest as Apollo? Was it Chekhov, who, again, was just getting used to the beetle wig that he was actually wearing, and the captain that requires complete information, the giant eel of Andos 5, etc.?
Well, I was struck by how the characters were quite well-rounded, and all the leading actors who played the regular characters that you're so used to didn't seem to be evolving, or they were kind of ready formed, if you see what I mean, in this particular episode, which I thought was interesting. There was a lot that I enjoyed. I particularly enjoy the lady who played Carolyn.
Leslie Parrish.
Because I thought that was an extremely difficult role to play, because she had to fall in love very quickly and had to kind of walk that tightrope between loyalty to the crew and loyalty to the Enterprise and also loyalty to the man that she had fallen in love with. And I think that she was given a very difficult role to perform in a very short space of time and not very many lines in which to get that. And I thought she handled that pretty well, to be honest with you. So I was quite impressed by her acting. I was also quite impressed by as you say, Chekhov and Sulu. I thought they were both very interesting, already formed characters, and fascinated by the whole concept. But the thing that struck me most about this, and I can't, what was the date of this this particular episode? When was it made?
67, I think.
67. Yeah. It's quite interesting that I think it was 68 that von Daniken's book Chariot of the Gods came out, basically espoused a similar theme, really, which was the idea that space people had visited Earth in a primitive time and they were the gods. So I don't know whether the writer knew von Daniken or whether von Daniken knew the writer or whether one influenced the other, but it was an interesting, at the time, I remember as a young man, I remember thinking, this is fascinating stuff, because this is really about the birth of organized religion, if you like, and how it could have developed and how science meets faith in a strange kind of way, which I thought was a very interesting theme. And so I think this episode had a lot more depth to it than a lot of other Star Trek episodes. However, they did tackle quite a lot of the issues of the day. They tackled feminism, they tackled racism,
the Vietnam War.
They tackled a lot of those sort of things. But this was really interesting, because it was a tightrope to walk about theology and gods and all that kind of stuff. So I thought as a piece of theatre on television, I thought it was very clever. I mean, I thought it was very interesting and well written. And that, to be honest with you, I had to look up Adonai as well, or Adonai, or however one pronounces it, to kind of find out what that was, because I had a vague memory of there being a Shelley poem with that in the title, but I couldn't remember. But basically, it meant God, didn't it? I mean, that was what we were talking about. So I found that fascinating as well. So yeah, it made me go and do a bit of research as well as a program. So
I enjoyed it. Son of Zeus, twin brother of Artemis, and of course the shocker, as James Blish revealed when he actually did the version of the script. There was a, was it the censors who basically objected to the original ending that was actually put in place?
I don't know.
I was coming to Larry. Larry
will know. I didn't know. Right. They have there's just a small scene when they get back to the ship between Kirk and can I say, I was a couple of things washed over me. One was, I forgot, this is a rare episode where Spock is on the ship, and the ship, we've got to find the missing people or the trapped people. Plots are kind of well done. There's some character, I especially love the Uhura scene where they're trying to figure out how to punch through and puzzle it out. But it's one of the rare times that the blue shirt standing next to Kirk is McCoy, not Spock. You know, usually the two of them are the big team. And I thought McCoy did just fine. He's spouting McCoyisms at the same time he's being the other guy.
Number but they one all, they on do our have list a, of things to do.
They have a good team approach going. But so basically the scene and the pages exist. It was part of the show all the way up until nobody in the studio. By the way, also we should say Gene Kuhn, Gilbert Ralston's the name on the script, but Gene Kuhn heavily basically wrote it, but in the style of the best showrunners, did not put his, you know, insert his name in. He let the first timer or the lesser experienced screenwriter get the residuals and have the name in the credit. But it was a Gene, it was a heavy Gene Kuhn rewrite. You know, that's why it feels familiar. That's why we're talking about Carolyn Palamas as a character. It's a lot the same that Madeline Rue had as Marla MacGyver's with Khan in Space Seed. Had to fall for him in a short amount of time and then have some, you know, there is some iota of her Starfleet training in there and loyalty to the crew at the end. And this whole thing about the gods, like Star Trek V, the movie comes back to this. But Russell Bates, who was a Native American writer who was mentored by Gene Kuhn in the time before he passed way too suddenly, lung cancer in 1973, one of the animated episodes was an homage to this and to Gene Kuhn, which is basically the same ground, only instead of a Grecian god, it's a Native American, it's an Aztec Mayan god, Kukulkan, that they run into that's demanding worship again. But it gives them an excuse to have, they finally have, there's a Native American ensign. And it was an interesting episode. And it's the episode that won the animated Star Trek, its only writing Emmy.
It's in our list of things to look at somewhere down the line, certainly.
Right, right, right. How Sharper Than a Serpent's Tooth is the very poetic name of that one. But no, the whole thing about the unworshipped God coming back to demand some kind, you know, God or God figure or leader, strong leader figure is one of those Star Trek tropes that Gene kept, you know, playing with. And but the scene that was taken out, they're back on the ship. It's a little tag scene. And basically, it's right here. Kirk says, yes, Bones, somebody ill? McCoy says, Carolyn Palamas rejected her breakfast this morning, which is a wonderful 60s cleaned up version of she threw up. Some bug going around. She's pregnant, Jim. I've just examined her. What? You heard me. Apollo? Yes. Bones, it's impossible. Spock, may I put a question? Spock said that. Spock, may I put a question to this gadget of yours? I'd like to ask if I turn to my sick bay into a delivery room for a human child, or a god. My medical courses did not include obstetrics for infant gods. And then that's the ha ha ha, you know, Flintstones yeah. ending for the show.
Yeah.
And it survived all the way until just a couple of days before they filmed. And then finally the network didn't want it. Desilu was fine. Their in-house time was fine. And the initial wave of network people let it go, but it got up to the top and they said, no, nix it. And, so it was gone.
I mean, there is a sense, actually, that Apollo actually commits rape in the sequence where we see the thunderstorm and all sorts of other things. And obviously, Lieutenant Palamas, when she comes out disheveled, she's had a fairly traumatic experience from that point of view. And I think that was probably where the connection had been made. And I think, yeah, it would have mm-hmm. certainly opened up a whole new range of issues with respect to the system. Pamela, what about your favourite characters, or indeed aspects of the episode?
Well, ridiculous. My favorite characters are not based on any kind of educated environment whatsoever. Okay. Planet Pamela here. Chekhov, because I love the name. I love the fact that there's a character called Chekhov. I mean, come on, that's brilliant, right? Anyway.
How old are you? 22, sir. Then I'd better handle it.
but William Shatner. I mean, William Shatner just has this way of, it's almost like this fine line between cheekiness and seriousness. And there's just this, he's like this impenetrable G.I. Joe guy, but he's also like so charming, but you think that he's probably, as soon as they, you know, they take a break and, you know, they cut, he probably says some kind of brilliant, ridiculous joke and cracks everybody up. I mean, I don't know. He's just got this thing. He's got this presence.
Don't get anybody in the co-star routine who's taller than me. That's always a good one.
Oops.
Serious. And then to know everything that he did in his later life, William Shatner, I just couldn't take my eyes off of him. You know, he was fantastic. So I think he and Chekhov kind of.
Yeah. And Robin, where are you going for this one?
Well, you know I'm a big Star Trek fan, but I'm going to go away from the cast for this one. I was thinking Michael Forrest, but I got to give it up for the big green hand. I love that big green
hand. The second Gene Roddenberry cameo. He was obviously the voice of the chef in Charlie X, and he had the hand in Who Mourns for Adonis. Amazing. Segued neatly into, of course, the scores. Jonathan, what's your score out of 10 for this particular episode?
Oh, I'm going to give this a 9.75.
Interesting. Wow. To find out what Jessica's going for. She'll be contributing on a sort of a pre-record thing. But Pamela, yourself?
Oh, goodness. I mean, I would give it a 10, but if it weren't for the, I guess it was the time. You can't blame the time, but there is a bit of sexism. What can I say? So 9.75.
Wow. Yeah, 9.75. Robin?
I'm going to go for a solid 8 on this one.
Oh, yeah. But at least you've reclaimed your curmudgeonly mantle, which is good.
How can I be a curmudgeon and give it 8?
Larry.
Wow, everyone's blown away by this. I, if you'd asked me this 24 hours ago, I would have probably said 6 or 7, just compared to everything else. But I gained a lot of respect watching this again with fresh eyes. For the first time in ages, all the way through. So I'll say an 8. I was going to say 7.5, but you've all pulled me up. Okay.
Well, there we are. I'll go 8.5.
Hang on a second. How about calling Larry a curmudgeon? And what's your score, Alex?
Look, Robin, you cannot. He's Dr. Trek. I mean, he's transcended all curmudgenly approaches.
What am I?
Wait a minute. I resemble that remark. Wait.
Yeah, he's and again, I would have to say, go on YouTube, type in Star Trek Continues, seek out Pilgrim of Eternity. It's a wonderful. I didn't expect to enjoy it as much as I did, Larry. This was one that I did think was extraordinary. But the message and everything else that comes across there, it works very well. So, just out of interest, why did you stop being Dr. McCoy?
The original actor who was going to be Dr. McCoy, they did the vignettes with. And then went away when the project started up. He had a daughter that was needing medical attention, and he felt diverted by that, and it was going to turn into a big time suck. And then also, I was trying to work on my documentary. I was trying to launch Portal 47 as a business. There were one or two other things going on. Oh, we downsized and moved that year. There were just a lot of things going. Oh, and I did Stellar Cartography at the exact same time we were filming this, which was insane. And I did not want to, it was the first cool nonfiction project for Trek in ages. And I didn't want to screw that up. And there were just a lot of things going on. And I did the first couple. And then Chuck Huber really, 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 really wanted to come back and play McCoy again. And he and the producer had been old friends.
You were gracious enough to step aside.
It was a combination of all things. Yes.
Well, next week, talking about graciousness, we're looking at the Brain Impulse Galvanoscope Record and Transfer. We're still in the 60s, Jonathan. So good news from that point of view, as we explore the question marks of Professor McLean and his adopted son, Joe, and of course, the World Intelligence Network, or WIN, with Uncle Sam Luva and indeed Shane Weston. And of course, the classic line, yes, I have flown the MiG-24/7 many a time. It's Joe 90, the first episode, Most Special Agent on Resonance Rewind. For the moment, Nari Nemechek, Jonathan Lindsley, Paola Suman, and Robin Pierce. Keep on resonating.
Thanks. Track well, everybody.